experience and effect against.
Which side are you on or something?
You're sitting next to Steph, flag from Grace. And so, two of you lose this. Oh, you get it so short. I agree with what you said, but I was very surprised to find that several of you brainchilds were together.
Yeah.
The southern.
Yeah.
And my quality.
That would be a nationwide. Internationally, when I was there, San Diego had a good brand. Absolutely. I didn't really see it there. Definitely felt it in, it was hard to engage the board members who always had a fair and lovely forum.
There are many.
To do the, hey, how are you? So, you know, it was hard to, there weren't enough people to advocate for the staff. Yeah, it was very bad. And I was always wanting to protect them as being kind of my hold to do that. But I never saw it with San Diego. San Diego always seemed to me to be well represented, you know, good staff. You know, they're just close at hand. They show up and, you know, they might have to work, they might not. You know, happy I ran into you, and I'm very much going on with this. So the relationships stay on the same. When Roberta's was here, I was.
Fran was here at almost all the time.
Maybe it's changed. I don't know if it's changed.
It's
okay. Okay, good. Yeah. But, I mean, they do change, but.
The meeting time. Exactly. And it's not very much.
Gary, I mean Eric, are you ready?
Good morning. I'd like to call to order the regular meeting of the Regional San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board. Chris?
Blair?
Here.
Ms. Cantu?
Here.
Dr. Olson? Not here. Mr. Strawn?
Here.
Ms. Warren?
Here.
Chairman Barbanel?
Here. First item of business, as usual, is public forum. We ask anybody who wishes to address the board on an item that's not on the agenda. You'll have an opportunity to talk to items on the agenda as they appear. And we want you to fill out what color card? We're actually pretty easy about the color of the card. But I think it's the blue ones, right? Is there anybody who wishes to address the board on any subject not on the agenda? Well, that was a lot of preparation. Okay, thank you. Move on to board business. We'll consider the adoption of the last meeting on February the 13th. Are there any comments or corrections from board members to adopt? I think, Megan, you since you weren't here, you have to abstain.
So moved.
So second. Moved? Okay.
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Abstain.
Ms. Cantu?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
Dr. Barbanel?
Yes. Okay, item number three. I'm sorry, I skipped. Dave, I forgot you. I'm sorry. Okay, item number two. Our comments from board members and then the executive officer's report. Our state board liaison got promoted, and we don't have one right now. but I presume somebody will be identified in the near future.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, and members of the board. Joaquin Esquivel does send his regards. He has been asked to attend a budget hearing today of small matter. Otherwise, he would be here today. And the state board has not yet decided on liaisons, but we will soon hear from them.
Are there any items that board members wish to report on? Activities, interesting things, whatever?
Oh, there it is. Disappears down. Yeah, I was going to say, where?
You've got your electricity working.
So red is on.
Yeah.
That is not intuitive. I had an occasion to be in Sacramento a couple of times in this last month on other business, and I took the fact that I was there to schedule meetings with the State Water Board and met with several people, including Joaquin, for an hour and a half, where he shared his vision as chair. And I have to say, I came out of that meeting levitating with excitement because I think he's got it completely right. It's not an easy task to implement, so we'll see how that goes. But the thing I take away and like to share with you is his commitment to the border regions, both our region and Region 7, which is Colorado River region, including the Imperial Valley and the Salton Sea, is he's going to really bring some energy to addressing those dynamics, the cross-border flow dynamics. And that energy, I was particularly thrilled. I haven't seen that kind of commitment since I was there, and I was a lone voice, so Pete Silva and I. So I'm quite thrilled that his commitment will serve us well in our tasks here. So that is something to be very excited about. Of course, he will be down here next week, so that kind of demonstrates that. He is after he leaves here, a Salton Sea hearing at the Salton Sea for the first time in history. So his commitment to being in regions is being demonstrated, and that's great. It's no easy task, and I'm glad to see it. I also met with the border team at Cal EPA to hear about what their interests and what their plans were. And I have to say, I came away with a sense that there's many bright spots. They're not all as well coordinated, and I think we can wrap them together with a focus that will be more successful. And I think we're well positioned here with Dave's leadership to do that. But again, I felt that they had a tremendous amount of energy and moving in the right direction. I also met with the executive director and got her priorities, and she was very complimentary of Region 9 and of the staff, the senior staff in particular, so I'm happy to share that. I think it was a good opportunity to kind of sit down and talk about what her priorities are for us and what our priorities are for her. So all in all, I thought it was a very good meeting, and I was happy to be able to go.
Okay, let us move on then to the executive officer report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the board, I'd like to ask, first of all, if there are any questions on the written report this month.
Well, I wanted to thank the action on the irrigated lands program. The agriculture has appreciated it.
Thank you.
And I'd like to compliment the staff getting out and getting it going.
They are indeed intrepid and effective, and it is a lot of work for them to do. And Ms. Arias, our water resource control engineer in particular, really deserves all that credit. And I am happy to report, though I don't have a name today, but I believe we have made an offer to a new environmental scientist to help her with that work. And so I'm hoping to see yet more progress on the irrigated lands. I'll mention just briefly a couple of things that are coming up. As I believe you discussed at the last meeting, San Diego State University is conducting a Water Days, and I've asked Wayne Chu to represent me, and Jill Harris, our newest senior environmental scientist, will also be attending that with Board Member Strawn, I believe. And so we've got that base covered. And I'm also happy to report that we are firming up our plans to be present at Earth Day at Balboa Park. We're taking care of the paperwork to have a booth available, and several staff have volunteered. If there are any board members who would like to join us for a portion of that day, we think we'd be very welcome. So we are also setting up that. I have been asked by the State Water Resources Control Board to give a quorum of the board and senior staff a tour of the Tijuana River Valley, and so I have set that up for Monday the 18th from 9 o'clock in the morning till 12:30. We'll start here and return here. We will also have the opportunity the following day to provide an update to the board in its regular meeting scheduled for the Salton Sea. So as soon as I'm done with that tour, I'll be driving over the hill for that meeting the following morning to give them the official tour. I've also been working with students from Southern California University. They are working on a modern technology project for journalism, including drones and 360 cameras. And so on or about the 29th of March, I'll be doing interviews and site visits with them down there, and I hope to report back how that technology has been used to advance the concerns we have for the Tijuana River Valley. That is all that I have to report this month, unless there are any questions.
Thank you. Well, Steph, do you...
Our April meeting has been canceled.
Yes, I'm sorry. We, for lack of items in Orange County, we've chosen to postpone the Orange County meeting this year to later in the year. We believe we may be able to act on the Doheny desal probably in November or December if all things go well. And it seemed more appropriate to have a meeting in Orange County later in the year when we actually had Orange County items. We also have a gap right now in several agenda items because they are piling up for May. The Poseidon in particular is occupying a lot of our time. So we elected not to have a meeting in April.
And, so, and the Poseidon matter will be heard in the at the May board meeting?
We are planning for that and working to that right now.
Okay. And did it seem from the public interest that when was a result of the tentative order being released that holding that hearing in Orange County would have minimal benefit or that we'd have enough folks come here?
Well, Poseidon wouldn't have been ready for April in any case, but okay. We just didn't have enough items to justify an off-road meeting up in Orange County. We would have had only two items on the agenda.
No, that's fine. I just, my concern, were to be completely transparent, I know we discussed in the past holding the hearing on the Poseidon permit in Orange County, and that was my concern when I saw that it had been removed from April. Not that we're doing it when it's not ready to be heard, but that it's being heard in a place accessible to those interested in the matter.
Yes.
Okay. And then I would sign up for the Earth Day volunteering to the extent we have to notice that if enough people volunteer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Want to go ahead and say something, Sarah?
No, I think you should.
Oh, okay. Dave was perhaps too modest, although it's item number two in his executive officer report, that this board, that doesn't mean the members sitting up here, but the entire staff, has been awarded a FEAT award by the San Diego chapter of the Sierra Club. FEAT stands for, I didn't choose this acronym, Fantastic Environmental Action Taken. I think it probably should be actions. And we will be one of the three organizations who is awarded this honor on May the 4th. I hope you all, if you're members of the Sierra Club, you probably are thinking of attending anyway. But if you're not, it should be fun. I don't actually know that a state agency gets these awards very often. In fact, it's the opposite. I'm
not familiar with any of the other regions or us getting one in the past.
Lawsuits is generally what they get, so this is quite a departure.
Right. So attorneys may be present at the dinner, but quiet. Anything else from Dave or questions of Dave? Okay. As you will see, we have a relatively brief agenda, and since I seem to have lost it, here we go. I need to know what the notes. Okay. All right. Number three is an item regularly on our agenda in which board members can express an interest in a topic to be covered at a future board meeting. We cannot act on it, and typically we don't have any particular information on such items, but they're a good way to sense the interest of the community as expressed to board members, and that's on future agenda items. Are there any suggestions on future agenda items?
I would recommend in May that we schedule a closed session to do the annual personnel evaluation of the executive director. Executive officer.
Okay. And I would like to suggest that we, in the relatively near future, have an update on what we've come to call the modern monitoring program. I had an opportunity I tried to get it onto the agenda of the annual chair's face-to-face meeting and was not successful. There are other items that were preferred by a majority of the chairs. It may appear at the WQCC meeting, but since we have taken the lead along with Region 2 and including Region 1 and Region 6, perhaps we can get an update, figure out what to do, and think about whether we want to make a presentation in October at the WQCC.
Certainly. I've been speaking with State Board staff, and there may yet be an opportunity for us to have a brief update and discussion on the modern technology in the enforcement item. As that project really grew out of the enforcement case for San Altos and some of the questions that the board had in terms of being able to expand our ability to surveil construction sites, among others, I will work with Yvonne West, the Office of Enforcement Chief, to see if we can have maybe 2 or 3 minutes just to briefly update the status of the project and queue up the discussion for our update later and then perhaps a presentation at WQCC.
So I don't think everybody is aware that we have been to talk to San Diego State, a group of faculty members there who wanted to incorporate as student capstone projects participation in the actual setting up and monitoring of the information one would collect with closed circuit television or satellites primarily. I had a brief exchange with Joaquin, who expressed great interest in it and I think would support hearing from the regions that I mentioned what we would like to do in the relatively near future. So we maybe should get our act together. So.
I will pass the chair of the State Board some information I've shared with Eileen Sobeck, the executive director, and John Russell, the Division of Administrative Services, on that SAGE project. The students and faculty at San Diego State have proceeded without us and have done a couple of projects already on irrigated lands, in fact. Very impressive projects for with minimal involvement from us, and so a very modest fee would gain a lot of traction with the faculty and staff and enable them to actually do meaningful work. And so as that was an interest in our conversation with him, I'll pass that information on and hope that he can perhaps motivate the staff of the State Board to find $35,000 for two semesters worth of work from anywhere from 30 to 300 students. This seems to be a real benefit there for the state as a whole if this is done. Because this program, SAGE, is underway at several universities around the United States. It's not just a San Diego State project. So there's some real long-term value and longevity to this type of effort, worth the small investment. I'll pass that information on to him. Thank you.
All right. And also, I don't know how the conversations are going, but I recall the city of San Diego has expressed an interest in working with us on monitoring the construction part of the Pure Water program, if I have
that work is proceeding.
And not to be outdone by that, I was contacted by the mayor of the metropolis of Del Mar to ask whether or not they could participate as well. They were really upset by their very large $40,000 fine, as opposed to the city of San Diego, which got upset by a much bigger fine and decided to work with us. So if we can throw him into the mix, he's also my neighbor, I'd appreciate it. Okay.
And I'd like to thank Jimmy for the action item list. That was really helpful. I might have missed it if we'd done it before, but it helped me. Thanks.
Okay. We have two items on the consent calendar. Moving on in the agenda, anyone on the board or in the public can take an item off the consent calendar if you wish to have it discussed and voted on. Are there any such items?
I don't have my agenda exactly in front of me at this moment because I was looking at something else, but is the Marietta on the consent?
Yes.
Yes, that's what I thought. I don't want to take it off consent, but I just have a question. A small question.
We have Darren Bradford of our staff available to assist you.
Okay. So my question is, in doing the siting or development or coordination, did this office or the developers coordinate with the Riverside Western Conservation Habitat Authority?
Oh, yeah. They brought this project into the pre-application meetings twice. and all the agencies were there, and we've all made comments on it. And
okay.
So have they.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Eric had a question.
Yeah, while you're up there, it kind of looked like an existing drainage basin. Is that what it was originally functioning as?
Historically, it was a recreational pond, basically. They lined it with bentonite clay. They used to pump groundwater into it and use it as a recreational lake, if you will.
Oh, for the neighbors kind of thing.
Yeah, but it's been abandoned for 20 years, and now it's surrounded by development on all four sides. And it's surrounded by chain link fence and stuff, so it doesn't really have any recreational use. Oh. Like, you can't really get down there except for some homeless folks. And so.
No, I was just worried that it was an existing
treatment facility.
I mean, a retention and,
no,
and
no, nothing like that.
It kind of looked like one. So
it does. Yeah, it does have that kind of function, but it's not for any development.
Any other questions, Darren? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent calendar. We can approve both items with one motion.
So moved.
Second.
Chris?
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Ms. Cantu?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
Dr. Barbonell?
Yes. Okay, we have two further items. Three further items on the agenda, which I don't think will take particularly long. So I anticipate it's 9:20-ish. Anticipate we'll be through with these items by an hour from now, maybe a little bit more.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, even perhaps a little sooner, as we did unfortunately have to pull item number 6 off the agenda for today. That was the update on the Santa Margarita Estuary.
Sorry.
So that leaves us with item number 7 and item number 8.
Okay. Even though we won't be here long, you don't have to leave. Let's move on to item number 7. It has my name on it, but that's because I suggested it under the future agenda items in the past. And here it is, and I think it's a report from the Ocean Discovery Institute rather than from me about the Ocean Discovery Institute, which would not be thorough enough. Who is actually doing the presentation? All right, well, let's postpone that and see if somebody from ODI shows up. Okay, we'll move on to, what happens when you put an item sort of on the side?
We'll just put it in the parking lot. I did receive a message from a person that they were about here about 9:15, but I don't think that that was for item number 7, but we'll see if our speaker is able to show up. In the meantime, we do have the staff and agents from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Mission, so we can continue with item number 8.
Right.
This item was requested at our last meeting, I believe, by a board member, Celeste Cantu, and we've been working with Customs and Border Protection for some years on the Tijuana River Valley Recovery Team, and because of concerns to agents' health and safety from exposure to the flows crossing the border at multiple points and handling persons who've been in those flows, they have conducted their own monitoring and assessment project, which they are able to report on the draft for those results so far. Very grateful for their assistance also in helping us with the tours I gave in January to the Office of Enforcement and Deputy Attorney Generals and State Lands Commission, and their assistance that we're anticipating on Monday with the State Board and Cal EPA staff.
Morning. Okay.
Hi. I'm Amber Craig, the Public Lands Liaison Agent for the Border Patrol here in San Diego Sector, and I'm a supervisor with the agency. And I've been there 21 years. All those 21 years, I've been assigned to Imperial Beach Station, so I have a pretty good background on what's going on with the Tijuana River down there. Thank you for having us to give you a brief update on what's going on in our world. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. So we've CBP, Customs and Border Protection, which is our parent agency, has been taking some efforts to try to mitigate the risk to the agents working out in the field. This all started about the 2017, that large spill that happened in the Tijuana River. And since then, CBP has taken some steps to work on this situation. So I wanted to share that with you folks and to update you on how things are going. The first picture that I'm sharing here is that I believe was the first rainstorm of the season. And I share it just to show the force that of the water that comes through the Smuggler's Gulch there. It's actually damaged our infrastructure because they didn't get the grates up quick enough. So for us, the things that end up deposited in the canyon collectors on the south side of the border throughout the year and over the summer and the debris and the trash and whatever else is basically flushed during those storms. So this is kind of a good example of imagining whatever has been sitting in those canyons being flushed north of the border. No presentation would be complete without some pictures of what we're exposed to there. This is Goat Canyon. Some of the collectors, we know that they're designed so that the water sits and dries out, but this is the kind of thing that we see in those canyons that just sits and sits and sits until it finally either gets scraped up or by the contractors for IBWC. So that's the green and black mush in Goat Canyon, hypodermic needles, other dangerous things, and then a lot of debris and trash and garbage that we see during the rainstorms. So that's common in the river valley, and all of that, you know, makes its way north throughout the valley. So today, you know, I'm here, I kind of described just to give you an update. We know that there's a lot of things out there in the water, but we don't know what it is, and therefore we don't know what to do for the agents. And so CBP had undertook the effort to do some sampling, to do some things. So we had three main goals. We had some near-term prevention and mitigation, things that we can control, and then we needed to identify what kind of infrastructure improvements that we would have to do. And then increasing our information testing and data gathering are things that we're after. So we did some things for our vehicles, put in some air filters in the vehicles that have to sit all day and that are out driving around in the dust and the dirt, whatever's kicked up around the river area. So cabin filters for all of the vehicles. For our facilities, we put in extra different types of washing stations for the agents and for the vehicles. I'm sure there were better things out there, but with the limited funding that we could pull, these are the efforts that we made in short notice. So nozzle attachments to clean the undercarriages of the vehicles. Our mechanics have to service the vehicles that have been driven out in the mud and whatever else the agents are driving through. So it's not just agents that are exposed, it's contractors, you know, mechanics and the people who help repair our infrastructure, the grading systems that you see in the photographs there, that we use to secure the border at where the water comes through. Agents have to go down and inspect those grates, so they walk down in that area as well, and then the contractors that come and repair any cutting that's been done to damage the grates, which happens on a regular basis. It's a constant, you know, effort to get through. Personal protective equipment, we purchased many things for the agents, cleanup kits, gloves, respirators, masks, privacy tents so they can change out their clothing if they get in the nastiness, so they don't have to get in their vehicles that way. Respirators and helmets for the ATV units, although that's been a little bit more difficult to find something that works, that fits well, and that the agents can don on and off easily and quickly. So some things are quite a challenge for us because of the nature of what we do and how quickly we need to do it. You know, we can't just wear the plastic nitrile gloves out while we're working because we're climbing and we're hiking and we're doing all these things where those gloves would get damaged. So it's a complicated issue for us to try to make it all work and make the agent safe. And then we have some services that we identified so that we can get our dispose of contaminated equipment and uniforms. Prevention, near-term prevention and mitigation. I think mitigation, one of the big things from my perspective especially, is that interagency liaison and intergovernmental liaison and trying to get parties that have a say or at least can try to influence to do that. And CBP is doing that as well. So the Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection put a team together at the headquarters level that is made up of people who help us with the health and safety, people who can liaison with Congress, people who liaison with the government of Mexico, and with our interagency partners, so that our commissioner is engaged, and then we have all these different levels of people who are engaged in this effort as well. I think that helps greatly, and I hope that everybody around and the stakeholders in this county are aware of that, so that they know we're trying and they're trying. And I think if everybody keeps trying, then hopefully at some point we can affect some change, influence some at least. So yeah, the liaison early warning and monitoring automation is something that we're looking at. We're going to have to try to fund something that will help us to detect either dangerous flows or something that might be off-gassing, also to let us know if someone is near our infrastructure so that we can make sure they're not damaging it, which lessens the exposure to have to go and repair the equipment or the grading systems and things of that nature. All of these things are going to be quite costly, but it's an effort that we're having to make in order to make the situation doable. We coordinate with the EPA and the IBWC, so right early on in March, CBP met with the EPA leadership. We met with the then commissioner of IBWC, Drusina, and since then we have met with the new commissioner, and we have ongoing meetings, actually monthly meetings at the headquarters level with EPA Region 9 and headquarters to carry on with this. Excuse me. You guys, everybody I think in this room probably already understands that the Border Environment Infrastructure Fund exists. That's something that we're focusing on as well, and messaging that's a very important for what we have going on, and that it's needed for agent safety and homeland security so that we can do our jobs and not be affected by the environment. So we're also emphasizing that with our representatives. The infrastructure in Mexico is something that needs to be worked on. We all understand that. That is something, again, that we're messaging at our levels of government, intergovernmental liaison. The enforcement piece is something that we still don't have a good grip on. We don't really have a way for the folks down in Mexico to go and investigate. When we see something coming over the border, we don't get that feedback of it was this or it was that, or it came from this place or it came from that place. And that's something that we continue to talk about, that enforcement needs to happen to try to help deter people who may be depositing things in the canyons south of Mexico that is being left there and nobody knows what it is or where it came from. So enforcement's something that we need to see, and we continue messaging that. And then of course, diplomacy. And I talked about how we are liaisoning with the government of Mexico. The sewage, Tijuana sewer runoff is a top bi-national priority for the 21st Century Border Management Border Infrastructure Subcommittee. That's something that they enacted in 2018, and it's continuing as a topic for 2019. So that's, we're pushing for that to continue to be a priority. So for CBP, this isn't over. It's not, these short-term measures that we've implemented are not, they're just a stopgap. We're trying to help get it stopped at the source. So quality assurance and accountability, that has to do with testing. So we needed to do our own testing. We need to see what we're exposed to. The agents go to the doctor after getting some kind of a rash, being exposed to something, and the doctors want to know, well, what were you into? Well, I don't know what I was into. I was in the Tijuana River. And then the doctors put on their gloves. Oh, you were in the river. So they don't want to touch it. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to be exposed to it either. But there's certain things we don't know. They don't know how to treat it if they don't know what it is that you need to be seen for. So we're running some testing. We did 6 months of sampling. I'll share a summary of those results, and then we're doing 6 more months of sampling of the water and the soil to try to narrow down the most dangerous elements and what we need to do going forward. So the sampling locations, basically the tributaries to the river, the main river channel, and then the drain, the different canyon collectors, Stewart's Drain, the Cañon del Sol, Smuggler's Gulch, Goat Canyon, Yogurt Canyon, and then the road at Yogurt Canyon. All of those except for Yogurt Canyon do have a diversion system that's run by the IBWC or managed by them, except for the Yogurt Canyon. And then that just comes over and sits on that road, the park road, the access to Borderfield State Park, and it just sits there. It's the road is the low point, and so whatever's on that road is, you know, potentially exposing the public to it as well. The sampling puts us in a better position to assess risks, and we share that information with the fellow, our stakeholders in the river valley, so that their staff is aware and they can know what they can do for their staff. The scope of the sampling that that we have done is very comprehensive, so VOCs, SVOCs, the metals, the inorganics, pesticides, herbicides, bacteria, of course, which everybody knows is in there. And I was having someone read over my presentation to look for typos, and they saw the numbers that I'll show for the bacteria, and it's funny how it's not even shocking to me anymore that, you know, 2 million parts per million when the maximum is supposed to be 10,000. You know, it doesn't even faze me at this point, but I forget what a big deal that is for people who've never heard of it before. The sampling events, we did dry weather flows. We were hoping to try to catch the things that come across that are unique and different, the pinks and the fuchsias and the greens and the blacks. Unfortunately, we had a hard time getting the contractors out right on time, so we weren't able to capture any of those. We were doing dry weather flows, some wet weather flows, after the rain, and then sampling pools of standing water. The observations that were made, that we did 42 samples in a period of 6 months. They were collected during a one-week period, so we would call the contractor out when we thought it would be a good week, and they would come and they would do their samples. They used the regional screening levels for tap water developed by the EPA. You know, we've been asked why we use that, because we don't drink that water, but the point was to be the most cautious that we could for the agents working in the field, so that's why we use that standard. And that helps us identify, again, what I've been speaking about, what are we being exposed to. We didn't, the results as they were summarized by our folks and the specialists who do that sort of thing, said there was no imminent danger that they found in any of the samples that were tested. Again, the trouble with that is you never know what came across at that particular day. Other days, things might be worse. So in the samples that we took, we did not find that there was imminent danger. We know that the flows are primarily untreated domestic discharges, including E. coli, Enterococcus exceedances that are typical to sewage. There are uncontrolled discharges that are occurring from industrial and agricultural uses that are originating from multiple points in Mexico and the Tijuana River. We know that based on the testing. And we're finding, you know, evidence of pesticides that are illegal to use in the United States, and they're coming across the border, coming from Mexico, and they're into our work area. So we had limited effort to catch those flows that we were hoping to get, those unique things. The data that was limited to surface water sampling, it doesn't evaluate the soil geology or other naturally occurring processes, so it's scientifically maybe not as comprehensive as it could be. We're getting better at it, but that's not our thing, right? CBP doesn't do soil sampling or water sampling, so we're learning about all this as we go along. And we do know that interagency collaboration is still needed. That testing told us we still need to keep working on it, and engagement with government of Mexico for sure. So I'm posting the results of the highest concentration of the contaminants that we found across all the sampling locations. So these were the highest exceedances, the most notable. The full report does have all of the information, but these are the highest concentrations. I don't know what all of these mean. I just know that these aren't good, and you can see the highest concentration in the first column there, and then the EPA screening level, recommended the screening level. So you can compare those two numbers, and then it has the location and the date that we took those samples. Same, it continues on, uranium, cyanide, arsenic, chromium. I know the for the agents, you know, when we see this, all of that looks terrible. So we had our staff come out and give us a briefing to explain that some of these things occur naturally, some of these things are just found in the environment, so we understand that. That's why more testing is needed. So while we are, as an agency, as the staff, we're pretty worried about the figures. You know, we understand that we have to look at it in totality. And so hopefully further testing will give us more information about that. And then down there on the bottom are the pesticides that I mentioned.
Excuse me, may I ask a question about this chart?
Yes, sir.
So sometimes these are all identified limitations on specific things, arsenic, chromium, whatever. Is there somebody who's made an analysis of the effect of the combination of all these things that you're exposed to?
They're definitely looking at it. So CBP does have a medical, senior medical advisor who's on staff and who is involved in this. That's the big question that we're all asking is what is the cumulative effect? And that's part of what we're trying to figure out. Yeah, single exposure, what's the big deal? Maybe it's, you know, maybe not so bad, but we're out there every day, and over a 20-year career, what would that be? What would that mean for us? So it's difficult since it's agents over time don't do a lot of complaining about the work situation or I don't feel well or I had a rash. And so until recently, they didn't even report it to us. Almost never did we get it reported. So, and they didn't track it. Mm-hmm. So going forward, we understand that if we want to know, we need to document all the exposures and all the rashes and all the illnesses and where we worked that day and what we might have been exposed to help us figure that out. It's going to take some time, but that's part of the process that we've implemented.
Thank you.
Getting them to do it is another challenge. They're busy, so. Okay, where were we? E. coli, the numbers. You know, you can see the numbers. What is that? I identified the abbreviations and what they mean. The road at Yogurt's Canyon, for example. I can't even read that from here. Is that 15 million parts per million out of, you know, the 10,000? High numbers that don't even faze me anymore. It's pretty sad. So pictures are great, again. So the impact of the personnel, this just happened this past early winter. The agent thought he could drive on that and found out quickly that he couldn't. So you can imagine where he ended up. This is the Goat Canyon sediment basin, so it's just north of that Goat Canyon collector, immediately north of Los Laureles Canyon in Mexico. It's a place that we see the most odd transboundary flows, the pinks, the greens, that's most often happens here. So this is what he looked like afterwards. He was the first person to use our special outdoor shower. Here's a picture. This agent was exposed at Stewart's Drain. It's a little hard to tell from farther away, but it's a pretty nice set of boots, not all old and beat up. And the toes, the sole of the boot is separating from the shoe itself. That's something that we see fairly frequently if you're out in working north of the Stewart's Drain. The Goat Canyon area, the Yogurt Canyon area, that has happened to different people in different locations where their boots separate, the soles of their boots separate. This person was exposed on the beach. He had gone in the water to get somebody out. A little while later, he noticed his feet were kind of burning. So when he took off his boot, that's what he discovered. He had his hand, reached his hand into his boot, so then it got on his hand, a little. If you look really close near the thumb there and the top of the hand, it's rashy, maybe a little blister popping up, and so it's irritated his hand. And that's just from putting his hand in the boot that had been in the water. And again, these kinds of things are fairly frequent if for folks out working out in the water. If you're out in the water, you're pretty likely to get some kind of reaction, some kind of rash, maybe very minor, a breathing issue, the clearing of the throat. You know, having your airway irritated is common. It happens to me a lot when I take people down on the border to look at the collectors. And after standing for, you know, at each collector for 15 to 30 minutes, I will start having, my eyes might start to burn a little bit, and I'll have the clearing of the throat. Not every time, but often. And then this agent was wearing his full uniform, and he apprehended someone. He had to tackle him. And he was exposed through his uniform, his vest, and everything. And this is what he looked like afterwards.
Do you also receive reports from the border flows?
People don't share that information with us. Occasionally, someone that we apprehend will show some symptoms, but a lot of times when we catch folks there, we move them along pretty quickly, and so we don't often hear about that. We recently did apprehend someone who we had to take to the hospital, and it was identified that they had MRSA. I don't know where they got it. It could have come before they crossed the border or during their crossing. I'm not sure. But that's the kind of thing that we are not surprised at all to find. Yeah. We do know that the smugglers will tell people to go through that contaminated liquid because they know that it's a safety concern for us, and that gives an extra potential for that person to maybe get away. So they'll direct them to go through that. So
I was thinking of residents or visitors to Imperial Beach, for example.
Yeah, they don't share that with us. I haven't heard. No, sir. So the next steps for us were, again, we're finishing up our second round of sampling that includes the soil samples. I think more or less the same parameters. They used the data that they did get the first round to kind of, you know, hone in what they're testing for on the second round, although we're doing soils for the first time. So there's a list of all the things that we are looking at. The locations are very similar. The Canyon Collectors, the Dairy Mart Bridge, the Hollister Street Bridge, just to give us an idea of what makes it that far down into the river channel, and the main channel area, pretty much the same places as we did before. And then we'll summarize that information once the six-month effort is over. We'll summarize that and share it in a similar fashion that we did for the first round, share it with the stakeholders. Okay. Well, I had some charts. I guess I did pull up the wrong presentation. The other chart I had was we keep a log of the flows that come across in the different collectors or dry weather flows, even at the river. And there was about 100 in calendar year 2018, there were 106 that we documented of just flows that showed up, that wasn't raining. There were just flows that came over the border, either at a collector. There were a couple in the river channel. That's a little more rare because they have that infrastructure there to try to prevent that. That often fails, I think, as most of us know, that it gets, you know, trash gets in it, or for some reason or another, they need to close it down. But so just an ongoing, never-ending issue. It just, even though everyone's trying to work on it, and it seems that our partners in Mexico are trying to work on it, at least in Tijuana are trying to work on it, they have too many infrastructure problems. So we're just, that's our part of it, and we're going to keep working on it and partnering up with the fellow stakeholders here in the River Valley. I'm all done with my presentation. If you don't have any questions for me.
Questions?
I have a question. Please. What are the circumstances in which an officer would find full body contact or partly body contact in a flow?
If they need to go into the water to capture someone who's gone through as well, or to get to a place, that's the only way to get to them is to get into the water, and then putting hands on somebody, actually affecting an arrest. If that person has been through the water at some point, then we will be exposed as well. And it's not good for the folks crossing the border either, you know, especially when they don't know what they're exposed to. Actually, I read the other day that somebody, a woman and her two kids, came underneath the grate system at Goat Canyon. When it rains, we have to raise those grates. And sometimes it's tempting for folks to want to try to come through. And she came underneath the raised grate into the water, under the water at Goat Canyon, which is coming from Los Arreles, and brought her two kids under the water through there. You know, we decontaminated them, but I don't know if they had any ill effects from that after the fact, but that's the sort of thing. That's how we're exposed. And then the ATV riders are out there all over the place. They can get to a lot of the places that we can't get faster. So they're driving in it. They're driving in the dust that's being kicked up. You know, we don't know what the effects are of what's in the dust and when it sits there, and does it stay? Do these hazardous, potentially hazardous materials, do they stay in the air and the dust? We're inhaling it on a regular basis. So that's how we get exposed.
Thank you.
Stephanie?
I have two questions. You said that the sampling did not reveal an imminent threat. Do you have a definition of what an imminent threat looks like to your agents?
Right. Basically the type of threat that would say you can't be out there. Yeah, you thou shalt not under any circumstance go touch any of that is basically what they mean when they say that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then my second question is, given that this has been an ongoing problem for decades, do you have data tracking the health outcomes of retired officers?
No.
Okay. I mean, I guess, yeah.
So this is
preview. Why not? And what are we doing to start trying to
get it? Well, you introduce yourself. He does a great job. We work together.
My name is Chris Harris. I've addressed you guys before. I just retired after 22 years with the U.S. Border Patrol. I've worked with Amber for that whole career. We went to the academy together. She went to the dark side, became a supervisor. I'm a union guy. My last position with the union was director of legislative and political affairs for most of Southern California. Like a lot of people, I got involved in this in February 2017 when, pick your number, but over 200 million gallons of sewage and chemicals flowed into the United States. One of the things is, from the union standpoint, we're pleased that CBP is doing some of this testing. My analogy to that is if you had a sewer main break in a city and the police department was testing it. You know, we're less than thrilled with EPA and rather strongly less than thrilled with IBWC. I've sat in meetings with Commissioner and others, and we've told them, IBWC and EPA, this is not our job. You guys are going to have to pick up the slack. We're going to do this now for a while to test, to find out what's going on with our agents, but you guys need to pick up the slack, whether they do that or not, you know, and that's why there's various lawsuits. The union's pleased with what they've done, but as you brought up what's imminent threat, we have a problem with that. We know nobody was dying. We're not seeing our agents dropping dead. But our concern is that cumulative effect. If you've worked 20, 25 years in it. When I came out here in 1997, it was El Nino, if you guys remember that. And I thought all you Californios were lying because it rained for, you know, months on end, and I was waiting for the 70s and sunny every day. So when I first came out, I was working midnight shift because I had no seniority, and we're working out in what we call the 90s. That's going out to a Borderfield State Park, that whole area out there, that's all rough brush and stuff. And you could see the level of the flooding on the trees, the silt levels, when it went away. We would see things. I saw things on the trees and on the ground that were blue and green blobs. And I remember my first apartment complex, I met a guy, and he was a chemist, and we were talking about it. He goes, Chris, I could probably tell you right now what that is, but can you get some pictures of that? It's like one of those little throwaway Kodak cameras took pictures. And he said, yeah, that's exactly what that is. I know that's cadmium and that's chromium. He goes, that stuff's really toxic. He goes, you're not anywhere near it. I said, you're near it. We run through it. So this is, and it doesn't go away by itself. I mean, this is kind of an EPA Superfund site type of thing. This is becoming a chemical dump. And so I've worked for the government for 26 years in federal law enforcement. I was with the Treasury Department before this. I don't trust the federal government. Look at Vietnam with Vietnam-era veterans, with Agent Orange. For years, they were told this stuff is safe. Well, you could shower it. I mean, you can gargle with it. It's good. But they had such a large sampling set, including working with the government of Vietnam, that they were able to show how many people were getting cancer. And finally, after about 30 years, the U.S. government said, oh, yeah, it's killing you. Well, I don't have enough of a large sampling set at the Imperial Beach Border Patrol Station to be able to show what's happening to my agents, the men and women who've done 20, 25, 30 years in this and then retired. And instead of living to maybe 80, they're dropping dead at 60. I don't have that sampling set. So that's a concern of the union. But I'm a human being. I recognize that this affects people that recreate down there. This affects people that live down there. Look, I work with Sergio Dean all the time. I don't always agree with his political views, but this poor guy is the mayor of a typical, the quintessential Southern California beach town, and his beaches are closed more than half a year. How do you tell people come visit me? You know, and it's happening in Coronado now. So it was brought up about the people that are going through there. Now, my job is to keep people from illegally entering this country. I took an oath of office, and that's what I do. Whether you like that or not, that's what we do. But those people don't deserve to get ill or die either. There are laws that affect it that will affect them. But Amber talked about a woman with two little kids. So if you just came from El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras, or Nicaragua, mud is mud. It's water and dirt. It's not a big deal to you. You've traveled 3,000 miles through it. So you don't know what this stuff is. And if you get past us, you're going to be in a load house for several days. You're not showering in there. So what is this doing to the long-term effect to the people that are going through it and the kids? This has been going on. We found newspaper articles going from the 1930s complaining about sewage coming in from Mexico. Well, now the union's been saying for years there's chemicals in this. And we got a lot of pushback from IBWC and EPA, especially IBWC, about chemicals in this. We've just proved there's tons of chemicals in there. And I disagree sometimes with the characterization, well, this is normal stuff. Radiation levels 11 times higher is not normal stuff. And I'll share this with you. I had a retired boss, manager of the Border Patrol, call me a little while ago. And he said, Chris, I know a little bit what's going on with that radiation, and I'd like to talk to you about it. And I said, okay. He says, do you have Tor encryption on your cell phone? I'm like, no, I don't have Tor encryption. He goes, I won't talk to you on the cell phone. So So I got to set up a meeting with him and talk to him, find out why there's these high levels of radiation. You saw a picture there of a syringe. That wasn't a syringe from a drug addict. That's medical waste. That's a large gauge needle. I took that picture. That's medical waste. We've documented areas where the hospitals are just dumping the stuff behind them in the rainwater and whatever goes through it. There's a lot of blame to go around. There's all these maquilas and maquiladoras down there. That they didn't go down there just for cheap labor. They went down there for lax or non-existent environmental laws. I had Darrell Issa on a border tour with me. And everybody knows Darrell, one of the richest guys in Congress, or was, made his money in the car industry. And he said he knew a lot of people in the automotive industry who had sent down their chrome manufacturing plants down there because of the egregious byproducts it produced. And they just dumped that. It flows into the canyons. And if it doesn't directly flow in right then and there, as Amber said, it'll sit there and stagnate. And then when the rains come, it floods into the United States. Those are chemicals. I don't know what the half-lives of them are for, but most of them are going to be there forever unless they're cleaned out. We talked to the EPA about doing a Superfund site. They won't do it if stuff is still flowing in, and I get that. So you were asking about also how agents can get contaminated. That guy with the rash on his chest, that was also because he was crawling around. So we crawl through a lot of stuff. We track people out. They low crawl, we low crawl. He got soaked. He's a former 15-year veteran in the United States Army. I said to him, did you report that? He goes, no, Chris, I didn't. He said, I did 15 years in the Army. I've done, 10 years in board show. You just suck it up and move on. So I've been trying to tell my guys and my men and women, stop doing that. And in a very short period, in a few month period, we had like 86 documented cases of our guys being contaminated. So this is happening on a day-to-day basis. Amber talked about the doctor putting the gloves on. That's my story. I arrested two guys that I tracked out. They came throughout out west, and they were covered in this purple-black mud. And when I went hands-on with them to search them, I had my gloves on, but I have short-sleeved shirts, my uniforms. I got the mud on my arms. I took my alcohol gel, and the government does that. That's one of the PPEs, is the alcohol gel, and I got it off. Literally within minutes, and I know the difference between literally and figuratively, literally within minutes, I had these huge rashes coming out of my arms. My supervisor came out there, looked at that, and said, man, you're going to the hospital right now. I'll take the prisoners. You go to the hospital. So I went down to the hospital off of Telegraph Canyon Road. And the doctor started, was looking at it, and he had the little nitrile gloves on. He's looking, goes, wow, this is nasty. What caused that? I'm like, I don't know. You're the doctor. You tell me. And I said, but I did get into the Tijuana River mud. Not exaggerating. He went, whoa. Took off the nitrile gloves, threw them away, scrubbed his hands and arms, and then put on these big, like, dishwasher gloves because he knew how nasty this stuff was. And because he couldn't identify exactly what it was, I had to take two prescriptions, topical and oral, to knock back whatever this was. And the other issue I have is with these high levels of E. coli and whatnot.
Can you wrap it up a little bit, please?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. So, you see these levels of E. coli that are so high, they'll tell you that E. coli can't kill you. Yeah, that's not true when it starts getting to that level. If you have any kind of compromised immune system, you can get ill from that. So I think I'll wrap it up now. This is an ongoing thing, and we appreciate the help from the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And we expect to see more things from that, and we hope to see more things. Well, thank you.
Are there any questions of Mr. Harris?
Sorry, I understand that there's a limited number of officers who serve in the southwestern border area, but as the union folks, are you going to implement a program to start tracking long-term health outcomes?
So we're in the early stages of trying to figure identifying on the whole southwest border where this is happening, because we're finding out it's not just in San Diego. Mm-hmm. But at this point, we don't have a long-term tracking program. Now, I know the head of CBP, the doctor, she's from the military. She wants to do kind of a DOD thing where they track it, and if you've been in an area, like by a burn pit in the military, yeah, it goes in your file. She's getting pushback on doing that. But the union is looking into to doing something of that on her own.
It just seems, not to be overly dramatic, but it just seems to me that there are parallels in the private industry that you could look to in terms of, like, tracking, shipyard workers' exposure to asbestos and whatnot through the unions, and tracking, the long-term health outcomes. It just, data is going to drive your arguments up to EPA and IBWC, and it seems much like the police doing samplings of sewer, I don't know that the Regional Water Quality Control Board has any business tracking long-term health outcomes.
No, I
certainly
get that.
Support that, but it seems to me that data presented to us and others would be extremely helpful.
So I think in honesty, the union is going to try to work with management to the best of our ability. I mean, we have some good relationships, and certainly on this, the long-term tracking, we're trying to push the agents to report it, and they're trying to start a database to record that. So I think if it happens, it'll be a hybrid between the union and management.
I agree with you, ironically, that you guys are actually having about as much effect as anybody on this tragedy at the border.
Yeah, I mean, whatever you think of the president, he saw a story we did with Malia Zimmerman in Fox News, and he tweeted about it, and that's what got CBP involved. And we're going to try to keep the pressure on with media. We're having, I'll be out with Controller Yee. She's coming down, I think, next week, and I'll be out with her with Surfrider. We continue to work with our fellow stakeholders. Surfrider's been fantastic. But it's a collaborative effort. It's a big tent, and we need everybody kind of doing their thing, but to keep moving along. Thank you.
Gary?
This probably goes back more to Amber. Two questions. One, you got a lot of data here. I'm going to assume that there's a open two-way street between your data you're collecting and what we have. I know we've been doing some surveys down there. Are you happy with how much crosstalk there is on sharing the water quality data that you're collecting and what other people have collected?
Yes, sir. Your staff has been outstanding throughout this, very supportive, and yes, we do share the data back and forth. We're a little slower on ours because it has to be approved to be shared, but yeah, no, we do get a lot of information. I do get a lot of support, and I'll have questions that I need a scientist for. You have staff here that help me out with some of those questions. It's really been wonderful. Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Yeah, we have good staff. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
The second part, do you have a good dialogue with our Navy friends down there? And I'm thinking particularly, I know the SEAL teams have a small staff that just works on equipment. You'd think that might be just stuff to blow things up, but I know they do a lot on protective clothing, and there might be some data sharing there that could help you. I know in particular a friend was working on some protective gloves and that you'd mentioned, so just wondering if that's open. I have point of contact there if you don't.
Okay.
So.
Okay. No, that is actually something new. We don't have good communication with them because they're separated themselves from the issue. So, but when it comes to something like that, I can't imagine that they wouldn't be helpful. So thank you.
All right. If you have an email address or something, I'll try and send you a link to friends.
Did we explain why there's four things that kind of jumped out looking at the stuff you presented? Was the pH? Did they explain why the pH is so high all the time? And then I noticed the uranium and the hexavalent chromium, which you would probably think the maculadoras and illegal dumping, and then of course the E. coli is just.
Yeah, I think that first round just gave us here's the big picture. The second round should hopefully help us narrow that down. I know that the ones that you mentioned there definitely were noticed by our folks as well. I don't know what that means. I just understand that more investigation is certainly needed. Yeah. I don't have our staff that understands the numbers, so I can't chime in on the pH issue either.
I do want to point in that the union was less than.
Please, you have to speak into the microphone in order for the.
I cover quickly. The union was a little less than satisfied with just doing the water, the surface, it was top inch. And we said, heavy metals, they're called heavy for a reason. The stuff sinks. So we pushed hard, and thankfully the CBP is going to do the sediment testing. And we're really looking forward to seeing, not in a good way, what's actually been accumulating in that sediment over a period of years. So just that, we look forward to seeing that data.
Are there other questions? I have a question which is really in the form of a suggestion as well. It seems to me that if this were occurring in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and it was Ebola, not the items that you're talking about, that the international community would respond, including there's an elite corps either at the Center for Disease Control or in the Public Health Service that does respond to these epidemic threats nationally. They're part of the United States government. That doesn't mean it's easy to find a way to talk to them, but could you maybe think about how to engage them? They are, after all, teams of scientists dealing with epidemics, devising strategies to mitigate the epidemic. That's hard because it's across an international border here. but dealing with the outcomes and a health protocol that both the union and the CBP might use to identify strategies to protect the health, not only of your officers, but also the citizens, both Mexican and exposed to this.
Yeah, I appreciate the recommendation, and I will pass that on to the team.
I wish I could remember the name of the elite corps that they have. Their image is from the medieval, from the Renaissance times, in which these people who did this kind of service wore big white gowns. They're not Ku Klux Klan members, but they were just, that was the protection that was available. And I don't know the answer to this question, but I'll ask Dave or other members of the board. Is there a California equivalent of the public health service that would be available? Because these are residents of our state that are being exposed as well as being officers.
Yes, there is California Department of Public Health. And so following on your suggestion a few moments ago, I will consider reaching out to them and asking for them to do their own evaluation. While we have some reports, mainly through Mr. Harris's efforts to actually lock down actual cases, mm-hmm. We've heard for a long time anecdotal reports of beachgoers and residents in Imperial Beach, but there's been no quantification of that, no epidemiology study. I think that that would be one specific request I would ask of a California Department of Public Health, and would be worthy also of asking the Centers for Disease Control, because the nature of these types of exposures, they may be sublethal, thank goodness, but cumulative effects, especially long duration and long exposure and frequent exposures where you see the longer-term health effects arise much, much later on. And you mentioned earlier synergistic effects between constituents that seem inconsequential, but taken together, they become consequential.
I'm not pretending to be a medical doctor. I mean, I would if I could, but I can't, so I won't. But that seems to be the kind of thing that these professional health caregivers could assist you. That is their mission. It's not yours. You are impacted by the mission, by your mission, in ways that weren't in the sales pitch when you joined up, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is there any other way in which the regional board can be of assistance? I'm glad to know that you appreciate what the staff has been doing. We strongly encourage it, and we're pretty proud of it, too.
Not that I can think of. They're okay. Very, very helpful.
If you
honesty, you're one of my favorite groups to deal with.
Oh, thank you. Come to the May 4th award ceremony. I think I can say, as you probably already know, that the executive officer and his staff are always available.
That's been very clear. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your time today. Dave, I assume that we have a copy of the presentation.
I believe we will be able to get one from our speakers today.
Okay. So in addition to the card, can you send your presentation to Dave and staff? I'm sorry?
The presentation will also be posted on our website.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, I believe you have a question.
Do you or staff know why the pH would be so darn high? What would cause that?
I'm sorry,
A guess why the pH would be so high?
Yes, I have several guesses. The information that's been collected by Customs and Border Protection and simple observations and reports indicate that there are episodic releases of industrial wastes. And so among other things, we do know that there is a tannery or a leather facility in Los Laureles Canyon and that they do dye lots. And when they dye, apparently they release their wash water. So we get greens, we get blues, purples, blacks. They also use chromium, though, and chromium treatment of leather. So we've seen elevated chromium there, and it's very likely that they may be using other products like lyes or other detergents that would elevate the pH. But that's not the only facility. We see that also in Stewart's Drain. We see that in Smuggler's Gulch as well. I will certainly take some of these findings and results, and I'm sure that the speakers will be at the California-Mexico Border Relations Council, but they typically have a public health update, and I will specifically ask in my presentation that the Border Relations Council, the secretaries of CalEPA and resources, reach out to the governor's office and to public health to request an epidemiology study and a more detailed assessment of the risks effects, both to Customs and Border Protection agents, U.S. SEALs, but also to the citizens and residents and recreationalists in the River Valley. There's an opportunity, perhaps again, there to elevate this concern.
So it wouldn't be the sewer water
the raw sewage?
That would have somewhat of an elevated pH, but nothing like what we're hearing about. It's more likely that those are lyes or detergents that are boosting the pH. Another purpose of having those updates to the Mexico, California-Mexico Border Relations Council is that it is frequently attended by representatives of the R Analog SPA and the US EPA Analog Semarnat from Mexico. And my opinion, my candid and blunt opinion, is that those agencies could be doing a lot more to issue their own enforcement actions and take actions that actually rectify these types of releases. When you have a facility releasing dyes regularly, and it's a rainbow, it's astonishing to me that the laws which are in place in Baja and Mexico are not being enforced, even on the most rudimentary level. It's one thing to have water that's opaque flowing down the drain, but when it's black as midnight or purple or orange and it goes on day after day after day, week after week, that's a clear breakdown in terms of the lines of civil authority over these types of releases. And so that is something that the Relations Council is intended to address. And so we'll make it a point to ask for their assistance again on this issue.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that closes this item. And
Mr. Chairman, I can report that our speaker for item number 7 has arrived.
Oh, good.
And perhaps this would be a good opportunity for a chemical, physical, and biological integrity break.
Okay. Let's, because we have a short schedule, let's take 10 minutes for that. So if we can adjourn and come back at 10:20. And we will hear from the Ocean Discovery Institute.
Dear one. And then you have to use the microphone. And it's on. Red light.
Okay, I'm going to call back to order the regional board meeting, and we will proceed back to item number 7. Oh, good morning. Please say your name for the record and speak into the microphone.
Hi, I'm Carla Camacho with Ocean Discovery Institute. I wanted to start by first thanking the board for giving us the opportunity to visit you all today and share more about the work that we do to engage young people from an urban community, City Heights, not too far from here, in ocean science opportunities. And I'm just here to share more about the work that we do and potential ways that you all might be able to get involved with ocean discovery. So today I'm going to be very brief, probably about 15 minutes, and just a roadmap of what I'll be sharing. I'll be sharing what we imagine our students to become, the problem that we're looking to solve, what Ocean Discovery Solution is, our mission and model, what our impact looks like, and our future. But before we get started, I thought I'd share a little bit more about who I am and why I'm here presenting today. So I've been a part of Ocean Discovery for about 15 years now. I've been on staff for 7 years. I'm now our manager of business development, really leading our efforts to engage our entire community in science and conservation. But that's not where I started. I was 14 years old when I first joined Ocean Discovery. I was a freshman at Hoover High School, the school that we serve. And I joined their Ocean Discovery's intensive summer program, where we go down to Baja, California, and do scientific research alongside scientists for 5 weeks over the summer, all completely tuition-free. My story is reflective of many of the students that have gone through our programs. And because of that experience, I was inspired to make a difference in our world. And so I was the first in my family to go to college. I graduated, and as soon as I received my degree, I wanted to come back to San Diego and work in the same community that I grew up in. And so I've been doing that ever since. And when I think about many of my peers that have gone through the program as well, they're now, you know, PhDs at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. They're deputy directors for our senators. They're environmental consultants all around San Diego. And really, that's the story and what Ocean Discovery is able to do in the lives of students that we serve. So we imagine a community where students from one of the most urban and underserved communities across San Diego are given the opportunity to believe that they can become a scientist or a leader in science and conservation who makes a difference in our communities. But we know we're not there yet, right? There's so much more work to do. And that's why we're here, you know, presenting to all of you today to show you how you might be able to be a part of that solution with us. So just to kind of share with you the problem that we're facing is that many people that live in urban communities like City Heights don't often see opportunities for them to succeed. They don't see scientists that look like them. They don't see environmentalists who really are making a difference, so they don't aspire to become those things. But, you know, they live in poverty. You know, many of the students that we serve, 99% of them are on a free and reduced lunch program. And so it really just highlights the need in this community for us to be providing these tuition-free programs. And what Ocean Discovery Solution is that we provide hands-on science programs in this particular community so that students can then unlock their potential and become these leaders in science and conservation. So that's what Ocean Discovery's work is all about, transforming young lives through science. And the way we're able to do this is by having a really focused approach in a single community. And so that's what we call our school shed. So similar to a watershed where all bodies of water flow into one main body of water, we serve a school shed. So that includes 11 elementary schools, 2 middle schools, and 1 high school. In that school shed, there's about 10,000 students attending those schools. Currently, we serve 4,000 of them. But in the next few years, we'll be able to serve every single one of those students in that community. And for about 20 years, we've been serving this catchment of students, and that's how we've really been able to see those transformative impacts in our students over time. And just to paint the picture of that high school, it's Hoover High School, it's where I attended, about 800 students enter that freshman class. Only 300 students actually make it to their senior year, whether it's that they drop out or they transfer to different schools. Only 60 students are even eligible to go on to a 4-year university. So when we talk about the need and students not being ready to go into college and take on these careers, we've really focused our efforts to serve the students of the highest need. So I've mentioned City Heights many times again. There's also, you know, so much rich diversity in this community. At that high school, there's over 30 different languages spoken. So when you think about diversifying these fields, this is really where we can tap into that group of students and really provide the opportunity for them to succeed in the future. We use the ocean as our platform. So oftentimes people ask, you guys are Ocean Discovery Institute, but you're situated in one of the most urban communities all across San Diego. But really the ocean for us is our platform to get students excited about learning. So there's not one third grader that you can't take out to La Jolla Shores and go tide pooling and have them not get excited about learning about science and their believe in their future in education. So really the ocean is our platform. It's our vehicle to really get students excited about learning. And it's our way to, you know, start introducing all of these principles of engineering, mathematics, conservation. And then we're in San Diego, so why not utilize one of our most amazing resources, which is our coastal environments. So the way we're able to do this is in our work is we just best describe it by our sustainable ecosystem business model. So as you all are well aware of what it takes to grow a tree, we imagine our students to be these small seedlings, these small trees that grow up to become these tall leaders in science and conservation. So our students, we start working with them as young as, you know, them being toddlers. They're these small, curious youngsters, these small seedlings, and we work with them all along their growth. But what's important for these seeds and these trees and is what we imagine of our students, is that they're rooted in a community that really believes in their potential. And so that looks like the mentors that work with them, that looks like the teachers at their schools, the greater community of San Diego that provides internship opportunities for our students. And so that's really important for the community that they're rooted in. Then our financial resources, Ocean Discovery provides all of their programming to students at no cost. So we really have to be able to anticipate what those financial resources are so that we can provide our programs tuition free. This is Ocean Discovery's where we shine the most, our core programs, right? So we provide that sunshine and core programming to students all along their growth. So, you know, similar to a plant, you don't put it out in the sun for just one day and expect it to grow. We provide that sunshine for them all along their growth. So once they're in elementary school and middle school, high school, college, and ultimately until they get into those careers, Ocean Discovery is providing the programs that they need to be successful, both during school and after school. And critical components of all of those programs is that it includes a hands-on science component, there's mentoring, and also those tools that those students need to be successful in life. So to paint the picture a little bit more about what our programs look like, you can imagine a student that's, you know, a toddler that lives in this community, sees Ocean Discovery and wants to be a part of the work that we do. They can come out on a Saturday with their parent and participate in a restoration activity, whether it's in the canyon pulling native plants and understanding their connection to our watershed. Then the student grows up, they're entering the elementary schools within the school shed, and during the school day, our instructors are in the classroom teaching them, taking them on field trips to the coast, bringing them to our new science education facility called the Living Lab. And then they get a little older, so then they want more opportunities, and they decide that after school, they want to continue participating in Ocean Discovery, and they have that opportunity to do so. You know, in high school, they could either, you know, join our summer research programs, they can join our college access mentoring programs, and then once they're in college, we're providing those supports and connecting them to resources on their campus, or if they're local, we're, you know, connecting them with internships at Ocean Discovery so that we can see them ultimately enter these careers in science and conservation. And we're seeing students, you know, that started in sixth grade and are now, you know, research scientist at Illumina, you know, biotech companies here in San Diego, and it's just incredible to see after, you know, 20 years really seeing those students coming back and making a difference and even teaching curriculum in the classroom with now the younger generation of students. So we're really seeing tremendous impacts in the work that we do. 30% of our students are showing an increase in their science knowledge when they're in the classroom. Against a backdrop in which less than 10% of low-income first-generation college students earn a degree, 75% of our after-school participants earn a college degree within 6 years. And so what we're seeing is that many of these students from this very, you know, urban community are coming back and becoming mentors for younger students. We now really imagine what it would be like when we can reach every single student in this community. So, as I mentioned earlier, we're serving 4,000 kids today. We just opened the Living Lab October 2018. It's a state-of-the-art science education facility in the heart of City Heights. And it's opened specifically to serve those students in that community. And with this facility now, we have the ability to, you know, literally have students walk from their schools to the Living Lab during the school day and after school, where they can participate in hands-on science programs. And, you know, I'd love to invite anyone here to visit us at the facility. It was designed by Rob Quigley, a very famous architect here in San Diego. And the reason why we wanted to create such a beautiful facility in City Heights was so that our students could walk into that building and truly feel that they deserve opportunities like this, because they've already proven that they can be successful if they're given those opportunities. The Living Lab celebrates water. We've loved taking advantage of a rain tube that we have in the building. As it's been raining these past few days, you can literally see water flowing through the facility. We have drought-tolerant landscaping all around the building. And this is just a place where students are, you know, discovering who they want to become and how they can become that person. So there's so many ways to get involved with Ocean Discovery. The first is, as I mentioned, all of our programs are provided tuition free, is by giving, learning more. Every Wednesday we have a tour of the facility that's hosted by our staff. So I invite you, if you want to see our programs in action and see the facility, every Wednesday there's an opportunity for you all to join us, and then volunteering. There's so many ways for you to, you know, volunteer in the classroom and be a role model for our students, or after school with our homework help program. So there's just so many different ways that you all can get involved with Ocean Discovery. So again, I just wanted to thank you all for your time here today, and I think we have a few minutes for questions if any of you have questions.
Oh, that was fantastic. We were really ending on a up note here. This is really great. What is your source of funding?
Yeah, so we have many different sources of funding. We have a $2.2 million operating budget to serve those number of students. And so it's a breakdown of individual giving, foundations, government grants, and corporate giving. Yeah.
So I really, really applaud what ODI is doing. I think it's great that all the programs that you use to inspire little kids, it's then sort of trickling up, if you will, to adding to our workforce and giving people the opportunity who probably wouldn't think about being a scientist at Illumina a chance to really have that impact in San Diego. It's fantastic. I was curious, you focus a lot on the kids, but especially with your new building facility, have you seen the involvement of some of their parents change maybe the way that they think about the environment?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that has surprised us the most. We imagined that we would first see a flood of maybe high school students or middle school students that can get there on their own, take advantage of the facility first. But what we've seen is the elementary school students and their parents are probably our biggest user after school. And so what it has created is this group of moms, essentially, that are our advocates and are taking flyers and calendars to the schools. They've even started every Saturday morning a coffee with the community, so it's more of like a way to invite other parents and families to learn about ocean discovery before they sign up their students for the after-school programs. So I think getting them involved has been tremendous in us being able to even reach the greater community of San Diego. I think there's still a lot of work for us to figure out how we can best utilize them to participate in programs with their students or learn how they can better support their kids with homework help after school. So it's like, so that you don't see parents drinking coffee and then the students running around and playing. We really want it to be a really integrated program. And I think we're working towards that.
That's great.
Thank you. I'm glad you made it short and brief and good impact. As Celeste mentioned, it's an upper in a day that has seen difficult discussions.
Thank you.
Do you have any suggestions how a state agency like the water boards can work with you? Are there counterparts to ODI in other parts of coastal California or on Lake Tahoe or other important water bodies?
Yeah. So Ocean Discovery is currently only serving San Diego and the City Heights area. We are looking at potentially replicating our model in similar communities across the country, but I would say we're many, many years away from that happening. In terms of having you all participate with Ocean Discovery, I know that many of you guys have expertise when it comes to understanding the importance of water quality and the water resource that we have here in San Diego. So I encourage you to volunteer first with Ocean Discovery and share that knowledge with our students, because I think one expertise that Ocean Discovery has is that we can translate understanding or bring together a group of students who are willing and wanting to learn about these topics, but we don't always have the experts who can share that knowledge. So I would always encourage you all to consider volunteering with Ocean Discovery so that you can share the knowledge and expertise that you all have.
So I was thinking of a different tack, which is, I'm sure, on the minds of both the students and their parents, is they participate in ODI.
Right.
Do that through high school. Mm-hmm. Some very large percentage of them go on to college.
Right.
And they'd probably like to have a job after that.
Of course, yep.
And a place where students or individuals trained with these skills can find jobs is here. That's who Dave hires.
Right.
He's the boss. Is there a way in which some of their students could come and have not a lecture, but a discussion, an informal chat with some of your staff? How many languages can we command here? Spanish, English, and Chinese, I know.
At least,
right.
Yeah. I can try my German as well, if that would be useful.
No, I think
yes.
Maybe we want them to work here.
Yeah. I think that it is really quite
I've
possible.
I've spoken German to him.
I think
quite a few of our staff would be very happy to assist in that way.
Would that be attractive to ODI?
I think that would be an incredible opportunity to have our students come and learn about job opportunities and even potentially even internship opportunities if they're local here in San Diego.
They can come. They can come speak this summer too. During when they're out of school, and then come in on a Wednesday. We can put an informational item on calendar, or we could just do it during the public comments. We've had other students come in, and it's been a huge hit. So I'm sure the board would be delighted to hear about a project that they're working on, or perhaps as one of the final measures of their 5-week program in Baja, a presentation about what they've learned. We'd be delighted to
awesome
be an audience for that.
Mm-hmm. I know that currently our middle school program is working on sea lions with the scientists from NOAA, and they're looking at how the effects of climate change are affecting sea lions and so sea lion populations, and I know they're always looking for opportunities to present their research at the end of that program, so I'll definitely keep that in mind.
Okay. Dave, I presume you know how to get a hold of ODI by now. Okay, yeah. Great. Thank you. Gary?
I may be duplicating something here, but I've been, over the past couple of years, doing a lot of work with a program called Trout in the Classroom, where we took, well, right now we have 300 students over this week that are all releasing their little fish into the, mostly over Lake Murray. But I know that Hub SeaWorld had a white sea bass in the classroom program where they would bring eggs in, set up the aquariums, let the kids, I mean, they'll go tomorrow morning at 8, I have kids with their little spoons putting eggs in, and then 10 weeks from now they get to go release them. It's a really great educational program. We've done a lot with the King Chavez Academies. we did 10 classes there this year. So I'm a real fan of how it did, and this is mostly third graders. We've done as young as first grade. We've had high school kids. The fascination they have of watching the eggs hatch and grow, and then and in the whole process, there's a lot of information about water quality and the habitats. And I do know they have a Hub SeaWorld has a pretty active program with that. I don't know if they're working with you, but I suspect they'd come over and help set up an aquarium and do that on a periodic basis for you if you wanted.
That's something we can definitely look into. I know that we just opened the Living Lab facility, so we're looking for the Natural History Museum has been interested, the Fleet Science Center, to bring their exhibits or things that our students can look at while they're there. So that's definitely a great resource for us to look into to see how we might be able to work with SeaWorld.
It's not SeaWorld itself. This is Hubs, which is a research institute that's completely separate. They just share the name. I could get your contact there if you want it.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. I guess with that, we are finished with our standard agenda items. And Catherine, do you want to take us into closed session?
Sure. We're going to be talking about items 9J and 9O today.
Okay. So let's see. We'll come back to report anything that's reportable after the closed session. But for this point, I'm adjourning the meeting until the closed session is finished. Thank you all very much.